WFAE streaming is funded by Garage Door Guru, providing local comprehensive garage door service for over 12 years, including detailed repairs and door installations, offering fine German-made garage doors. Details, go garagedoorguru.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Blackbeard the Pirate was famous for his notorious operations around the British West Indies and the American colonies in the 1700s. He captured a French vessel and rechristened it Queen Anne's Revenge and decked her out with 40 guns. He allegedly tied lit fuses under his hat to frighten his enemies. Together with an alliance of pirates, he blockaded the port of Charleston, only to come to an inglorious end on November 22, 1718. After his death, and down through the centuries, to this very day, in fact, rumors of hidden pirate treasure abounded. That treasure was supposedly hidden here in North Carolina, and people have been searching for it ever since, speculating on the great riches in golden doubloons it might contain. Enter Kevin Duffus to burst that bubble. Duffus has been a guest several times on this program, an author and nationally recognized historical researcher. His work uncovered the whereabouts of the lost light, the Fresnel lens that went missing from the Cape Hatteras lighthouse at the start of the Civil War. He shed light on many of the 400 shipwrecks off our coast in the so-called graveyard of the Atlantic, and most recently revealed some of the untold stories of how World War II impacted the coast of North Carolina. But back to Blackbeard. Kevin Duffus says he knows the whereabouts of Blackbeard's treasure and joins us this hour to fill us in. Welcome back.
It's great to be back, Mike.
I know you were just saying off the air that you think you've been on this program now seven times, and I know we've talked about Blackbeard before because you wrote The Last Days of Blackbeard the Pirate.
Correct.
But the information we're about to talk about is not in that book. The British Royal Navy had a run-in with Blackbeard 293 years ago, which ended his career and his life and severed his head from his body. They immediately overran his ship searching for treasure. They never found it. Others have searched. But you say that you have found it, and it is not what most people have anticipated it to be. It isn't a pirate chest. So among the 250,000 items that they have brought up from the Queen Anne's Revenge, none of those are the treasure. What is it?
Well, and actually, it was a year ago that the North Carolina newspapers published a story about one of the anchors being pulled up from the bottom there in Beaufort Inlet, and it was described as a pirate treasure, the anchor. And I read that and didn't think that an anchor, Blackbeard would have not considered an anchor a treasure, unless it was the last anchor he had and he was being blown ashore in a storm.
Or he encrusted it with jewels.
Right, exactly. But it was a number of months ago that I was at a speaking engagement, and I was met by a woman who owns land on the Pamlico River near Bath. And she came up to me almost whispering and said, "Tell me, do you believe that Blackbeard's treasure is still buried somewhere around here in Beaufort County?" And I said, "Yes, ma'am, I can say with absolute certainty I believe Blackbeard's treasure is still buried there in Beaufort County." And she told me, "Great, I'm going to keep looking for it." And I said, "Well, I'm not sure this is this is the kind of treasure you're going to want to find." And this is, I think, a very important subject that has been overlooked by history. Most historians completely have completely missed the fact that, first of all, the Queen Anne's Revenge was previously the French slave ship La Concorde, and when Blackbeard captured it, there were something like 475 slaves aboard. He kept 60, and 6 months later, he arrived in North Carolina, and when he wrecked the Queen Anne's Revenge in Beaufort Inlet, he tricked the majority of his pirate company. There were anywhere from 300 to 400 pirates in his company at the time, and it's often been said that he wanted to downsize his company to actually increase the shares of loot among his closest friends. And he departed the inlet after disbanding most of these men. And aboard his smaller vessel was 40 white men and 60 Africans. And pirate historians who've written about this have said that this was an example of multiculturalism, and the fact that pirate crews pirates didn't see color and how wonderful it was. Some historians have even waxed lyrical about the racial diversity of Blackbeard's crew, that 6 out of 10 of Blackbeard's pirates were black. But what these historians either don't tell the public or haven't thought of on their own is that 5.5, 6 months later, when Blackbeard was killed at Ocracoke, he had aboard his ship only 6 Africans. One of them was killed, and the other 5 were captured. So you have to ask the question, what happened to these other Africans?
54 of them.
Correct. Mm-hmm.
What happened to the rest of the 400 on the La Concorde, which was a slaving vessel? Did he get rid of them in the Caribbean? Did he sell them? What happened to them?
Actually, he returned them to the French captain. And the fact is, this the subject of slavery sometimes is difficult for people to talk about or to hear. But this ship, they lost a number of slaves on the passage, about an average number due to illness. Mm-hmm. But I'm fairly certain. I mean, first of all, Blackbeard, to have taken all 475 slaves and put them aboard a ship would have been enormously difficult. Especially, it would have stressed the provisions, mm-hmm. The water and the food would have been created in incredibly cramped conditions, and would have been almost a security issue for Blackbeard and his pirates. So they only took 60, and I guarantee you, they took the 60 healthiest, strongest, tallest, most vibrant of those slaves.
Okay. So when he was captured and finally put out of business, there were 6 Africans aboard his ship. So there were 54 that he brought to Beaufort at the time when he scuttled Queen Anne's Revenge, which we'll talk about. So what did happen to the 54? Are they the treasure that you're talking about?
They are, in fact, and I began to research this in great depth, and I began by realizing that to fully understand and comprehend the history of Blackbeard and pirates, you needed to know more than just pirate history. As a historian, I needed to understand the political and economic and sociological climate of the time. And there were a number of events that took place, very significant, either peculiar, suspicious, or revealing things that took place during Blackbeard's last 6 months in North Carolina that I believed, when you connected all of the dots, revealed a completely different picture than has been previously believed.
In fact, you are alleging collusion.
Well, absolutely. I don't. One of the very peculiar events that took place, of course, was the governor of North Carolina, upon supposedly meeting Blackbeard for the first time, issued pardons to him and his fellow pirates when he had to have known that they weren't eligible for those pardons in the first place, because the pardon that had been issued by the King of England only forgave acts of piracy prior to a certain date. And after that date, Blackbeard and his men had committed something like 12 acts of piracy, which included the blockade of the port of Charleston. And some of these acts of piracy were so sensational, including the burning of a New England ship off of the coast of Honduras and the blockade of Charleston. They were so sensational, they were published in the colony's newspaper of the time, the Boston Newsletter. And I find it really hard to believe that Governor Eden wouldn't have known about these things, but he issued the pardons to them anyway.
But didn't he also get a pardon or have a pardon offered to him by the governor of South Carolina, and he chose Governor Eden of North Carolina over the South Carolina governor? Is that not true?
That's absolutely true.
Why was South Carolina offering him a pardon, just to stop him from continually blockading the port of Charleston?
Well, all of the colony's representatives of the king, which included the governors of the various colonies, were issued instructions to offer pardons to pirates. And the reason was that England was about to engage in another war with Spain, and the King of England needed all of these pirates to come back and lead a somewhat honest life as privateers.
And isn't that how he started?
Yeah, basically. I mean, that's how it is believed. I actually think he got started differently. Maybe we can get into that later. But the fact is, when Blackbeard learned, he learned of the existence of the king's pardon on December 5th of 1717, and over the next 7 months, he literally sailed past four different colonial governors who could have issued this pardon to him, but instead, he made the point of sailing directly to North Carolina. He had to get to North Carolina. He had to get to Governor Eden, and for some reason, before he arrived, he had some reason to believe that Governor Eden was going to give him this pardon, whether he was eligible for it or not. And what I find especially suspicious is that the moment that Governor Eden signed the paper and said, you know, you're pardoned, he actually exposed himself as being an accessory to piracy, aiding and abetting piracy. And that alone could have, had Governor Eden been tried and convicted of that aiding and abetting piracy, he could have been executed. He could have been hanged just as if he were a pirate.
So there would be no reason for him to do that unless there was some sort of plus side for him, whatever that plus side may have been. That's what you're getting at here, right?
Absolutely.
And there had been a reason behind him doing it.
Right. And historians have said the plus side is that Blackbeard passed a few gold nuggets to Governor Eden, and that was enough to cause Governor Eden to be willing to risk his life and his career and his reputation and the reputation of his family back in England. And I find that to be absolutely absurd. I think that there was something else that motivated Governor Eden.
History says that Blackbeard surrendered to North Carolina Governor Eden because the area around Beaufort, I guess North Carolina itself, offered a less effective mercantile lobby to oppose his pirating efforts. What does that mean?
Well, what it means is that in other communities, such as, let's say, Philadelphia or Boston, there was some pushback among the business community against pirates. In the decades preceding, there were a number of colonial communities that embraced pirates because they were able to avoid a lot of the trade restrictions that existed. They were able to import a number of items that were otherwise unattainable. So piracy had been accepted for many, many years, but then as these towns began to see the benefit of an honest economy, they decided that they didn't need pirates anymore. The fact is, I actually think the mercantile lobby or the business community of North Carolina actually sent these pirates, who weren't pirates at the time, but they sent these men who came back as pirates out in the first place. And I think that's actually the basis of why Governor Eden gave these guys pardons when they came back, because he felt responsible for them.
They were doing the state's business or the colony's business at the time.
Exactly.
So why would that be? We have to set the stage for that, because evidently, and you talk about this, the economic situation in North Carolina was fairly dire at the time. South Carolina and Virginia were thriving because they had deep water ports and they could bring things in and out very quickly. And so all of our heavy stuff had to come through South Carolina and Virginia, much to our chagrin, and probably because was it taxed more? Did they make it more onerous on North Carolina to get things in and out?
Well, absolutely. And actually, Virginia completely banned the importation of North Carolina tobacco into Virginia ports in order for it to be shipped elsewhere. So if you were a settler or a pioneer and you decided to move into North Carolina and you were given 400 acres of land, you were really in a tough spot. Yeah. You know, there was nothing you could do with it.
We have to take a break. Kevin Duffus is our guest, author of The Last Days of Blackbeard the Pirate. We're also talking about the pirate treasure that Blackbeard is allegedly known to have had and what it may be. Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
And you're listening to Charlotte Talks right here on 90.7 WFAE, your source for in-depth news. Where support comes from, WFAE members and Blumenthal Performing Arts presents Reduced Shakespeare Company, the ultimate Christmas show, a festive, funny trip through the holidays tomorrow through Sunday in Booth Playhouse. Tickets at 704-372-1000. Tomorrow on Charlotte Talk, Charlotte native and former Episcopal Bishop John Spong on prejudice, Christianity, and more. That's when Charlotte Talks, tomorrow at 9 on 90.7 WFAE. Keep up with our political blog, The Party Line, to help navigate the waters of regional and national politics. Read WFAE's political analyst Michael Bitzer at thepartyline.org.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, Julia Child would have turned 100 this year. A new biography describes how America's first celebrity chef changed the face of public television and how we think about food.
Tune in to the Diane Rehm Show this morning at 10 here on 90.7 WFAE Public Radio for the Carolinas.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Kevin Duffus is our guest, a historian and author of The Last Days of Blackbeard the Pirate, which we talked about several years ago, the book. We're talking about new information, a conclusion that he's reached about the what Blackbeard's treasure really was. And he is saying that it was the 54 African slaves that he left in Beaufort, whose contributions to that area continue through their descendants to this very day.
Left in Bath, actually.
Left in Bath. Right. That is essentially what you're saying here. And we're talking about, and we're going to bring in another historian in a minute or two who does not necessarily agree with you on this, but let's lay some groundwork about why you believe this is what it is and why Governor Eden may have felt obliged to pardon Blackbeard the Pirate well after the pardon was available from the king, and put himself, the governor, at risk in doing so. The economy of North Carolina was stressed at the time, and we were talking about the strength of Virginia and South Carolina. There were also laws on the books in Great Britain governing trade in the colonies that, if enforced, would have hurt the colonies. And Virginia had laws on his books that you say hurt North Carolina, the tobacco law. They couldn't bring tobacco from North Carolina into Virginia to take it out in a deep water port. Plus, Native Americans were also giving North Carolinians a tough go of it at the time.
Yes, absolutely. The war with the Tuscarora devastated eastern North Carolina. A number of people were killed, and in fact, it was the initial attack took place in September of 1711, mm-hmm. and it was considered a terrorist attack of its time, and numbers of people were killed. But the result was, and it was immediately followed by an outbreak of yellow fever. There had been a drought, and as a result, a few crops had been planted for a number of years. There was no hard currency in the colony. Money was hard to come by. There were few commodities.
And the British Parliament had said that hereafter a certain date, all debts to the crown, essentially the leases on all this land that we were occupying, that the crown owned, had to be paid in pounds sterling. Well, there was no pound sterling in North Carolina. There was no, all they had was goods, so they had to pay in commodities.
Exactly.
They couldn't ship those commodities.
Right, but there just happened to have been an event in July of 1715 that produced an unfathomable amount of pounds sterling. It wasn't sterling, but it was Spanish gold and silver that were spilled as a result of a disaster where 11 Spanish ships were wrecked in a hurricane off the coast of Florida. And the fact is that historians have often said that it was out of work. When England and Spain ended their war of Spanish succession or the Queen Anne's War, a number of these privateering sailors were suddenly out of work, and that's what sort of spawned the great age of piracy. But I contend that it was actually the wreck of the Spanish treasure fleet, which spilled millions of pesos of gold and silver on the beaches of Florida. And we can prove that by looking at the letters of some of the royal governors. Alexander Spotswood of Virginia sent a letter to the king saying, if you give us a little bit of encouragement, we would love to go down and try to salvage some of this treasure to the benefit of His Majesty's subjects here in Virginia. the governor of Jamaica, of course, didn't think he needed the king's permission and sent an out-of-work privateering captain named Henry Jennings to Florida to see what sort of gold or silver he might be able to come home with. He brought back 120,000 pieces of eight after a very small amount of effort. And the fact is that a number of the colonies then began dispatching men in small sloops to go to Florida to see what sort of treasure they could bring back. This was a godsend to Governor Eden, who had been 1 year on the job. His treasury was bankrupt. The Lord's proprietors were demanding cash payments for taxes, essentially. And here's the source of all the money we need. Mm-hmm. And it created a frenzy.
You describe it as not unlike the gold rush in California.
Absolutely. In fact, during the gold rush, there was one miner who sent a letter to his wife, I guess, who woke up one morning and he was gone. And he said, you know, I had to go out to California to try to get a little bit of money so that I won't be a dog for other people any longer. And I believe that was the same sort of mentality that a lot of these young men who later became pirates had.
So how did Governor Eden profit from this shipwreck off the coast of Florida? Did he profit?
I don't know that he profited.
Did he send Blackbeard?
Well, actually, I can't prove it. I mean, yeah. And I know there are plenty of historians out there that will say that it's total conjecture on my part. Okay. But the fact is that the greater number of Blackbeard's closest associates upon returning to North Carolina, I can trace to families along the Pamlico River in Bath. Now, there are some historians who say, well, that's just a coincidence that their names are identical to the names of men who were on Blackbeard's crew. But in the deeds and records of Bath, there is a repetition of these names.
It's been a couple of years since you've been on the show talking about Blackbeard, this book, Blackbeard, The Last Days of Blackbeard the Pirate. But I recall in the back deep, dark recesses of my mind that when we talked about this, you say that Blackbeard kind of hung around in North Carolina when he wasn't on his ship being a pirate. Am I remembering that correctly?
Well, I wouldn't say that he hung around. And actually, the stories, the history that people say that Blackbeard settled in North Carolina and sort of bought himself a nice house and had lavish parties, I don't believe any of that's true. He wasn't here enough. No, it's my contention, and it's the one part, you know, I'm not trying to push out there ahead of the rest of this information or research, but I do believe Blackbeard had connections or ties to North Carolina prior to becoming a pirate, yes.
Okay. Let's get back to the slaves, because there were these 54, he brought 60 slaves with him on the Queen Anne's Revenge, which he then wrecked in the harbor, in the Sound, and then was discovered by the British and put an end to by the British with only six. So 54 ended up somewhere in Bath. Did he sell them? Did he give them to the planters who needed them? Did he set them free? How did he dispose of them, do you know?
Well, I actually believe that the slaves were treated as just as if they were gold or silver, so that all of the members of Blackbeard's crew had a proportional share of the total number of slaves. I actually believe Blackbeard only had four. He had four slaves. Captains usually got, I think, two shares in a quartermaster, you know, one and a half or two shares. David Moore can speak to this directly. But the fact is that if you go back and look at the deeds of Beaufort County, I found, for example, two slaves had been purchased by Governor Eden's council secretary, a man named Tobias Knight, who was believed to have had a close relationship with Blackbeard. He reported in the colonial records that he purchased two slaves from Blackbeard's crew. By the way, the value, based on the value of those two slaves, because Tobias Knight died a year later, in his estate inventory, there was a value placed on those two slaves. And based on that value, I was able to extrapolate using a modern calculator the value of the total 60 slaves Blackbeard brought to North Carolina in 1718. In today's dollars, they would have been worth somewhere between $8 million and $10 million.
So even then, a fortune.
That was the fortune. But other slaves appear in the records. One of Blackbeard's quartermaster, William Howard, was captured in Norfolk, and he had two slaves with him. Governor Eden in a document from one of the Royal Navy captains involved in this story, reported that Governor Eden actually had a couple of or had some slaves from that had been sold from Blackbeard's crew.
So, because North Carolina had no deep water ports, they had, and there weren't ever a lot of slaves here in comparison to some of the other southern states. But the slaves that did come here through Virginia and South Carolina, correct, for the most part?
Yeah, as I was saying earlier, if you
so this would be a godsend.
Absolutely. If you were a settler and moved to North Carolina and lived somewhere along the Pamlico River and were given 400 acres or 600 acres of timberland, what could you do with it if you were sitting there by yourself or with your wife and your children there? And, you know, so they needed a labor force. The reason why Virginia and South Carolina were so far advanced economically than North Carolina was that the deep water ports meant that they had slave markets. In South Carolina at the time, there were something like 9 or 10,000 slaves versus 3,000 in population. In North Carolina, it was almost the opposite. There were 3,000 slaves to 18,000 whites living here in the colony in 1720. So, yes, it's and if you needed to purchase slaves, if you were a North Carolina planter, you'd have to travel to Williamsburg or to Charleston or to Philadelphia to the slave market. And when they found out you were from North Carolina, you know, you were offered
the highest price
for the probably the sickest, weakest slaves.
So bringing these 60 slaves to Bath, who, as you said earlier, were chosen specifically because they were strong and healthy, etc., was unlike anything they'd ever had access to. I'm curious where they had the money to buy these from Blackbeard, if that is in fact the case.
Well, and again, they didn't buy – all of the slaves weren't purchased directly from Blackbeard, but purchased from members of Blackbeard's
crew.
Well, even
crew. So, where did they get
but the
money?
But the thing is that there are 15 members of Blackbeard's crew who are unaccounted for, who left the crew and went on and lived their lives. So we don't even know that they even sold their slaves but returned to Bath
and took them with them.
And took the slaves with them.
If given that we had no deep water ports and we had to depend on North Virginia and South Carolina to bring any slaves that we were going to get into this area, why was Blackbeard able to bring 60 in? Why couldn't they just bring ships in to Pamlico Sound or one of the areas and just let them off the boat? Why did you need a deep water port?
Well, he brought them in what has been described as a small Spanish sloop. Mm-hmm. It was probably somewhere in the range of on deck, probably 60 to 70 feet long. And granted, from the day he left Beaufort Inlet and sailed through Ocracoke Inlet and went up the Pamlico River to Bath, the conditions aboard that small Spanish sloop must have been extremely crowded because, again, he had 100 men aboard, 60 of them being slaves. Now, the slaves, of course, almost certainly were not shackled or, you know, they were probably free to walk around and in fact, they were obviously helped operate the ship as well, not knowing that when their usefulness came to an end that they would be either sold or given to someone else. So,
well, since 1997, divers have been bringing artifacts up from the wreck of the Queen Anne's Revenge to the surface of Beaufort Inlet in North Carolina. David Moore is, we've already referenced him, he's a nautical archaeologist with the North Carolina Maritime Museum and a Blackbeard historian who has researched the pirate's history for 30 years. He was to have been out on the water this morning participating in further exploration of the wreck of the Queen Anne's Revenge, but weather, I'm told, has prevented that, which allows him an opportunity to join this conversation, and we're very pleased to welcome David Moore to our program. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Mike.
You're welcome. Now, let's begin in a different place than I thought I was going to begin with you, David. Let's begin with your take on the idea that Blackbeard's treasure was, in fact, these 54 slaves that he left behind in Bath. Could that be true, in your opinion?
Certainly. I actually been listening here for a few minutes, and I'm not finding a whole lot about what Kevin has been saying to be untrue. I mean, it's he's right on with a lot of what he's been saying.
And the reason I ask is because I understand that when his book came out, Blackbeard, The Last Days of Blackbeard the Pirate, you are one of the first people to review it, and you did so in a magnificently negative way.
Well, that is the way it turned out. But what happened there, and Kevin has actually made mention of this in several places, that I didn't say anything about the positive aspects of the book, but the original review did.
Oh, okay.
And it was very heavily edited towards the negative, which I was somewhat unhappy about. But be that as it may, yeah, there were several things with the book that I took issue with. I don't, for instance, agree that the Blackbeard was, in fact, from North Carolina. And Kevin himself even says, you know, in the book in several places that, you know, historians will, you know, have to take a leap of faith to jump on board with a lot of the hypothesis that is mentioned within the pages. And he's right. And that's one of the big things that I have a problem with, is believing that, in fact, Blackbeard was from North Carolina originally.
You know, I could be wrong about this, but I think Kevin is one of the first people to say that Blackbeard's treasure does not rest in a chest beneath the sand. It is, in fact, these slaves that he left behind in Bath. If he is the only historian to allege that, why is he the only historian to come up with that theory?
Well, I don't think that many people have actually dug that deep. Now, I will say that those so-called 60 slaves that Blackbeard did keep when he took Concord and allowed the captain and crew, one of his smaller sloops, to take the remaining slaves up to Martinique. In fact, it took two separate trips from the island of Beckway to get up to Martinique. They did allow the French crew to keep a lot of the beans, which were essentially food for the slaves, and so we know a lot of that happened, and we know it from French documents. But actually, a good number, if not the entire number, of those 60 slaves were in fact reclaimed. We have another document that basically talks about one of the vessels under Blackbeard's command ran aground in and around Grenada, and a lot of those slaves were able to be reclaimed by the captain, Pierre Doucet, because of the mark of the ship. Of course, you know, those who are familiar with the slave trade are familiar with the fact that a lot of these slaves would have been branded, basically with ownership marks, a lot of times with the mark of the ship itself. In other words, Concord may have had, a branding iron with LC for La Concord. And so a number of those slaves were, in fact, reclaimed. However, the point that Kevin makes about Blackbeard bringing slaves into North Carolina is still indeed true. I'm not sure exactly how many slaves he may have had left over from having taken Concord earlier, but he was known to have taken another slave ship coming in from Angola into Charleston with a number of slaves on board. I think it was over 80, in which he basically took 14 and was overheard to say, tell the captain he was getting a baker's dozen. Those slaves did remain with him. Basically, he took that ship between the blockade of Charleston and his entry into North Carolina, or in fact when he lost Queen Anne's Revenge here off of Beaufort Inlet. So he did in fact bring a number of slaves into North Carolina. So that is certainly true.
Okay, we're going to take a break. We're going to come back with more with David Moore, nautical archaeologist and Blackbeard historian with the North Carolina Maritime Museum, and Kevin Duffus, author of The Last Days of Blackbeard the Pirate, in just a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
And you're listening to Charlotte Talks here on 90.7 WFAE, public radio for the Carolinas. And support for our programming this hour comes from WFAE members and the North Carolina Dance Theater, presenting Nutcracker, a Charlotte holiday tradition with over 100 performers and live music by the Charlotte Symphony. December 8th through 23rd at Belk Theater. Tickets at ncdance.org. Coming up at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show, a new biography offers a portrait of one of the most fascinating and influential Americans in our time. It's the story of Julia Child's search for her own expression, published on what would have been her 100th birthday. Sunshine today in Charlotte, a high around 62 degrees, clear tonight, with the low expected in the upper 30s, sunny tomorrow and a high near 68. It's 50 degrees in Charlotte.
Hi, it's us, Click and Clack, the Tapper Brothers.
Thinking about a new car with all the latest technology?
You bet I am.
Like ABS and GPS?
I was thinking of, like, doors and windows.
Well, if you're getting rid of a car that's still in good shape, donate it and get a tax break. Call 1-866-789-TMCP.
TMCP?
Take my car, please.
That's 866-789-8627.
Or go to WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks, WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about Blackbeard the Pirate and his treasure actually still being around, not under the sand, but being the legacy of the 54 African slaves that he brought with him on board the Queen Anne's Revenge to Bath prior to his being put out of business by the Royal Navy. We're with Kevin Duffus, whose theory this is. He's a historian and the author of The Last Days of Blackbeard the Pirate. He's in our Spirit Square studio with us. And in the last few minutes, we've been joined by David Moore, a nautical archaeologist for the Blackbeard historian with the North Carolina Maritime Museum, who has been involved as a Blackbeard expert for 30 years and recovering artifacts from the Queen Anne's Revenge. Given that pirates are so closely associated with treasure, David, and since that is the aspect of pirates, I think that still fascinates a lot of people today, particularly pirates of this golden age of piracy in the 1700s. Why is it, because you say not a lot of historians have dug into this aspect, why is it that historians have not dug into the pirate treasure aspect of Blackbeard? Why haven't you? You've been doing this for 30 years.
Well, I've been trying to cover all the bases. I think Kevin was mentioning earlier, and I totally agree with him, unless you get a much better idea of the historical context within which these guys were operating, you know, the economy of the time, the political aspects, you know, studying the Royal Navy and its movements, et cetera, you're not going to get a full picture of what these guys were all about and what they were trying to do.
Let's get from both of you some more history about Blackbeard. He captured this French slaving vessel, La Concorde, and renamed it Queen Anne's Revenge. Why the name?
I'll let David answer that one.
Okay.
There have been a number of theories with that entire thing. One of the better ones that I tend to kind of go along with was the whole Jacobite movement, you know, during this period, which is, again, is getting into that whole political structure of what was going on back home in England, with the Jacobite line and versus the Hanoverian line. The Queen Anne was, in fact, the last of that line of the Jacobites, and under whom he served, very possibly as a privateer, earlier in his life, which is something, I don't know whether Kevin has come across anything, but I certainly have never come across any actual proof that Blackbeard was in fact a privateer earlier. It's also interesting to point out that prior to becoming, turned into a slave ship, Concord was actually a privateer herself. So, what we're dealing with out there in regards to her physical remains is not only, you know, very probably the remains of Blackbeard's flagship, Queen Anne's Revenge, but also a slave ship prior to that, Concord, and which served as a privateer during Queen Anne's War, even earlier. So, you know, there's a number of different thoughts and theories relating to why that ship's name. There was another pirate, the name escapes me at the moment, a little earlier, who was also using the same name. There was another Queen Anne's Revenge before Blackbeard's. Now, whether there was any association with any of that crew, with Blackbeard's crew, the chances are certainly there. But the name may have been carried over, or they may have been chosen for the same reason.
So this ship was scuttled, essentially, 293 years ago in Beaufort Inlet. and yet recovery of items from it have only been going on since for 15 years. Why? We could scuba dive 60 years ago. Why did we start uncovering this treasure or artifacts from this sunken vessel only 15 years ago?
I don't think anybody really realized it was sitting out there.
How could they not? Where would it have gone?
Well, that's a very good question. It's been a no-brainer for me since I was in grad school at East Carolina back in the early 80s. I basically put together a research proposal to go looking for not just Queen Anne's Revenge, but also the smaller sloop Adventure, which was also run aground and lost within a so-called gunshot of Queen Anne's Revenge. And actually another vessel, one of his last prizes, what we call the Sugar Ship, that he captured off of Bermuda and brought into Ocracoke Inlet and ended up burning to get rid of that evidence. But a lot of the sugar that came in on that ship was the same sugar that ended up in the barns of both Tobias Knight and Governor Charles Eden.
Well, does that then give credence to some of the things that Kevin Duffus has been saying about perhaps collusion between the governor and his staff, at least, or some highly placed people in that area, and Blackbeard, making Blackbeard essentially an employee to bring in goods and services?
I think so. Now, whether I wouldn't go so far as to call him an employee. I think, you know,
a contractor.
You might get away with calling it that, but I think Eden was essentially just turning a blind eye to the activities of these pirates.
So you have recovered 250,000 artifacts from this vessel in the last 15 years. What kinds of things have you been bringing up to the surface?
Well, it depends on how you look at it as far as the numbers go. We've brought up close to 250,000 artifacts with just the lead shot alone. We have recovered almost 250,000 lead shot from the site. So if you take each and every one of those individually, sure, those numbers really jump up. Truth is, we don't know how many artifacts we've recovered because so many of the artifacts come up in these concretions, basically a matrix of very cement-like matrix of sand and seashells, basically mixed with the corrosion products when a lot of the iron artifacts begin to corrode underwater, basically creates this very tough matrix in and around the artifacts and stick a lot of them together so we can recover something that's, say, 2 feet by 2 feet by a couple of feet big, you know, a little bigger than the size of a basketball, but it might have, in fact, 100 artifacts encased within the whole mix.
And can you dissolve all that stuff over time and see what you have?
Oh, sure. And, of course, we X-ray as well up in the lab in Greenville. All of the artifacts, all of the concretions prior to getting into them with air scribes and breaking that concretion down. But it is a very long, tedious, and, in fact, boring process to do that. And so that's really what's going to take the lion's share of time in completing this project. It's not the excavation out on the site so much as it is needing warm bodies to actually conduct a lot of this conservation back in the laboratory.
This is in the inlet, and so it would seem to me that just like any other shipwreck, over time with currents and water flow, that the debris field might be much larger than the ship itself when it went down. How far away from the ship are you finding things?
Well, you got a couple of situations going on. You know, for instance, with Queen Anne's Revenge, it was a vessel that was run aground. It can be argued, and in fact is, quite a bit, even amongst the crew, whether Blackbeard actually did that on purpose or not. It's a very interesting question. I tend to believe that he did. I believe the pirates who deposed down in Charleston during the Steed Bonnet trials, that he did run the vessel aground on purpose. I don't think they had anything to hide by lying about it. But it from an archaeological standpoint, it becomes a moot point. She was run aground. Hence, archaeologically, she's a very compact site to work. She's not scattered out over a great large area of sea bottom.
What's your theory
compared
on the,
to, for instance, the Whydah, Sam Bellamy's Whydah that wrecked off of Cape Cod the year before during a storm? Is scattered over several miles of ocean bottom, so it takes a lot more time to actually locate a lot of the material.
Kevin, what is your theory on whether or not Blackbeard purposefully wrecked the Queen Anne's Revenge?
Well, I agree with David, and I agree with Steve Bonnet's crew that he most likely ran it aground on purpose. I mean, and David will...
And why would he do that?
Well, to get rid of, I mean, he had accumulated so many men over the course of the previous year or two. I compare him to the typical corporate manager whose company grows so fast that he passes people in the hall and doesn't know their name. And so they had to find a way to increase their own shares of the treasure by reducing the size of the company.
Because they didn't hand out paychecks. To the fellow pirates, they gave them a share of the treasure. So this is human greed,
and I'm sure there was some question as to how they were going to divide. He retained 400 men. Uh-huh. How were 400 men going to share in the value of 60 slaves? That must have been a bit of a conundrum for them. And so the solution, of course, was to he literally pirated the other pirates' loot. And I don't think there's any question that he did it on purpose.
I'd like to hear from both of you about Blackbeard himself, because as we have said many times in this program in the past, when I talked to you last time, I think, and this time, he was notorious. He was known all over the world. He's still known. He's one of the most famous pirates that ever lived. And yet, what did he really do? He never killed anybody that we know of. He never assaulted any women. He never made anyone walk the plank. What did he do that made him so notorious?
Well, I'd like to start by just saying that when you study history, you realize that all history is flawed to some degree, but none so much as that history that I think has been warped or distorted by popular culture. And certainly Blackbeard's history has been badly distorted and sensationalized by popular culture and by Hollywood. So, that's what I'm fighting against, is trying to sort of steer the ship of history back toward the truth, and to get people to pay more attention to the reality.
So was it just David that he allegedly lit fuses in his hair to scare off his enemies and had this black flowing beard that made him look dangerous? I mean, and maybe crazy. Is that what made him so notorious?
I don't necessarily, and of course we'll never really know because we're talking about events that occurred 300 years ago, but I don't think this particular pirate captain was as notorious during his own lifetime as he would become through history. I think a lot of that has developed over the years from fictional accounts to various stories that have been written, movies that have been produced, et cetera, et cetera. And I think a lot of his notoriety comes from the actual name itself, the nickname Blackbeard.
Now, I know that the Maritime Museum has a pirate exhibit, and that exhibit tells the story of Blackbeard and other pirates and the whole thing. But Kevin tells me that nowhere in this state is there any indication in these exhibits about the economic conditions that perhaps led to some of the troubles that North Carolina faced and that perhaps led to Governor Eden becoming in league with Blackbeard. And there's nothing in those exhibits about African-American contributions or the legacy of these 60 slaves that came with Blackbeard to North Carolina. If that's true, why is it so?
Well, it's not necessarily true. We do cover as many of the aspects of the historical and archaeological as we can in this one exhibit. Right now, we've got just over 300, not counting all the huge numbers of lead shot, but around 300 unique items on display, which is the largest exhibit that we have put together, been able to put together to date. But what I have to keep telling people is this is literally just the drop in the bucket. It's the tip of the iceberg. It's going to be 25 times this size eventually, because we've got of all the artifacts that we have recovered from the site, and we're continuing to do that literally now. We're in right in the middle of an 8-week expedition to the site. As you mentioned earlier, having been weathered out. In fact, I just had a little thunderburst come through here.
Mm-hmm.
We've recovered probably ballpark somewhere between 55% and 60% of the site. So ballpark, half of the shipwreck has been excavated. Of those half the artifacts that have been recovered, we have only seen maybe 10% of that. The rest still being locked up in concretion in the laboratory. So there is so many artifacts that we have not even looked at or seen, not to mention the roughly 50% that are still left on the bottom out there that we have yet to excavate. We've got a very long way to go, and we're going to be covering a lot more ground as we increase our space and getting into a lot of these side stories, particularly the slave trade. This is something I'm very much interested in, the fact that she was a slave ship. I actually wrote my master's thesis at ECU on another slave ship, so that whole aspect of what he was doing is totally fascinating to me.
But those artifacts are what you call the material culture of piracy, but the fact is that those humans, those slaves that were aboard the ship and imported into Bath, were the flesh and blood legacy of piracy. And Mike, if you were to go to the Bath State Historic Site and to try to learn about Blackbeard's appearance in Bath, you won't be told any of this. And the fact is that possibly, within just a few miles of Bath, there may very well be descendants of those 55 Africans who were sold or put into work in the Bath area. By the way, I wanted to get this point in, is that for the first time, slaves were used to purchase property in Bath 2 weeks after Blackbeard's arrival there in the summer of 1718. That was the first time in history.
So another connection to that. With that, we have to stop because we're out of time. And I know that, David, you want to say that this is going to come to the exhibit, and it very well might. David Moore, nautical archaeologist, Blackbeard historian with the North Carolina Maritime Museum. Thanks for joining us. Kevin Duffus, author of The Last Days of Blackbeard, the Pirate.
Charlotte Talks with